You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney.
The real outperformance has been the U.S. corporate high yield.
Are the companies lean enough? Have they trimmed all the fat?
The semiconductor business is a really cyclical business.
Breaking market headlines and corporate news from across the globe.
Do investors like the M&A that we've seen?
These are two big-time blue-chip companies.
The window between the peak and cut changing super fast.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney. On Bloomberg Radio.
On today's Bloomberg Intelligence Show, we dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies in 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we'll look at why Tesla's first quarter deliveries missed Wall Street expectations.
Plus, we'll look at why things are looking up for the shipping company UPS.
But first, we begin with the Walt Disney Company. This week, shareholders handed CEO Bob Iger a big vote of confidence at the company's annual meeting.
The shareholders rejected activist investor Nelson Peltz's bid for a board seat and elected all of Disney's choices for the board. Peltz's Trion Fund Management holds a Disney stake worth more than $3.5 billion and has been pushing for seats to address lagging shareholder returns.
Also in the news, Paramount Global, the parent of CBS and MTV, is getting closer to a deal to merge with independent producer David Ellison's Skydance Media. For more on all this, we were joined by Geetha Ranganathan, Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst on Media. We first asked Geetha for her take on this week's news.
Definitely a huge sigh of relief for, you know, both Bob Iger and the management team. I mean, it would have been, I think, a very, very publicly embarrassing thing for him if Peltz had won. So this is definitely, I think, gives them something to cheer about, at least in the near term. So I think it's really business as usual, right? They have their work cut out for them. They know exactly what they need to do, whether it's finding a proper, good ESPN digital strategy, whether it's getting the streaming business to profits, and more importantly for the board, whether it's chalking out a really bulletproof succession plan this time around.
And on that succession plan, is the expectation, Geetha, that they will hire from within, or will they try to make a big splash by hiring an outsider? How do you think Disney would like to proceed?
Disney has always kind of looked within, Paul, and you know this well. I mean, the last time that they went external was back in 1984. That's when they hired
Eisner.
You know, Michael Eisner, right, the Barry Diller protege. But after that, it's always been internal, right, whether it's Bob Iger. I mean, it was Bob Iger after that for almost 15 years. And then, of course, you had Bob Chapek for a couple of years. And then, you know, we have Bob Iger 2.0. back again. So they've always kind of had, you know, more, they've always looked internal, and they do have four solid candidates. So all the division chiefs kind of emerging as potential successor candidates. It's just going to be up to how they groom them. Is Bob Iger going to do something very similar to what he did with, you know, Tom Staggs and Jay Rizzullo, kind of have that COO position for somebody whom he's kind of looking to elevate?
What's the time frame here, Geetha, for this?
It has to happen pretty quickly, Alex. I mean, Bob Iger's term, which was initially when he came back in November 2022, was supposed to be 2 years. They extended that out to 4 years. So we have until the end of 2026.
Yeah, okay. And he's been known to
extend.
And, and he could do that because most shareholders are like, hey, Bob Iger's better than anybody else out there. We'll stick with that. All right, so things seem to be settling down, a little bit of stability returning to Mickey Mouse. How about at Paramount Global? It's almost the opposite. Are they going to sell the entire company, parts of the company, super voting stock? What's going on there?
Yeah, so it looks like now they have, or they've entered this period of exclusive talks with Skydance Media. And Skydance Media has kind of been, you know, this on again, off again, interested party in the Paramount company. But of course, they didn't want to come out with a bid for the entire company, at least up until this point. They always kind of wanted to do it in a slightly different way by kind of taking control of the voting stock with through National Amusements and the Redstone family. Now it looks like they're kind of going to engineer like a two-step process where they first take control of National Amusements and then go about and merge Skydance with the entire company, with Paramount. So still, I mean, there's just more unknowns than knowns at this point. There seems to be some report out there suggesting that they would need to do an equity deal raise of at least $3 billion. That's going to be really dilutive for the current shareholders. Again, we don't know exactly how much Sherry Redstone is demanding for her voting stock. There are rumors out there suggesting it's upwards of about $2 to $2.5 billion. She also owns about close to almost $1 billion in economic stake in Paramount. So again, too many unknowns right now, Paul. But, you know, we do definitely have concrete talks. That much is for sure.
So is the Apollo thing like off the table, right? Because that would be more of a piecemeal approach to Paramount, right? Even though the cash deal was better.
So the Apollo thing was actually, initially it was piecemeal, so, but they only were really interested in the film studio. They did not want the TV networks. They did not want the streaming asset. But it looks like when reports emerged about the Skydance deal, they said that Apollo actually had made a $26 billion offer, an all-cash deal for the entire company, which Sherry Redstone, for some reason, basically said no to.
So what's the future? I mean, this is the Paramount studio, Geetha. This is one of the prize jewels in Hollywood. I mean, what happens to this company? I mean, is it going to remain a publicly traded company? Is it going to be taken private?
I think the most likely outcome at this point, Paul, is that it still very much remains a public company. You know, we know that David Ellison is really only interested in the studio portion of the business. And you're absolutely right. It's an iconic studio. There's no doubt about it. They have a very, very valuable studio lot right in the heart of LA that's worth maybe upwards of $1.5, $2 billion. So obviously there's a lot of assets that he likes, but only with the studio business. So again, the question is, yes, he can keep it a public company, but he might really kind of trim it down, try and find some buyers for the TV network, for probably the streaming platform, and just make this like a pure play kind of a film studio with, you know, production and licensing operations, very similar to like what Lionsgate is doing.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to Geetha Ranganathan, Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst covering media.
Back in January, Bloomberg Intelligence came up with a list of 50 companies to watch in 2024, and now they're back with a list of 10 companies specifically for the second quarter.
This is based on scenarios from our BI analysts, who sorted through the barrel to find the good apples across sectors and regions. For more, we were joined by Tim Craighead, Bloomberg Intelligence Research Director for Content. We first asked Tim to talk about the companies on this list.
A couple of things to keep in mind here, top 10 for 2Q. These are part of a broader set of focus ideas that we've got. There's roughly 75, 80 of them right now across sectors, across regions. These specifically have important catalysts coming up in 2Q that we think can bring the market around to our perspective. All of these focus ideas have really strong, high conviction, fundamental views that we think are different from the market, and these catalysts should bring that awareness around. It's a group of U.S. companies. There's four of them. There's three in Europe, three in Asia, and they span the gamut from healthcare, med tech products to big financials to tires. So interesting group.
And Tim, one of the ones that, you know, I've been kind of thinking about, I just think these Olympics in Paris are going to be just huge. And I'm thinking about ways to play it. You guys have one of them in the lodging space. Talk to us about that opportunity.
Yeah, we do. Accor. It's a big French hotel company. You might not know Accor, but you probably know some of their underlying brands.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody who's made a hotel booking as of late knows that the prices seem to be really high, surprisingly so. That's feeding Accor's RevPAR, their pricing, which is playing through into profit margins. And the catalyst for these guys is, in fact, Paris Olympics. We should start to see early booking data over the course of 2Q heading into Summer Olympics. Now, Paris is only one part of their portfolio. They're across Europe and Asia, and we're seeing a strong, sustained travel recovery story that we think is better than consensus expects.
But apparently they have to like clean out the Seine. Did you read that? That
yes.
There's so much to
you. I'm not going to do.
Like, can you imagine being an Olympic swimmer and like there's garbage hitting you in the Seine? I mean, they're working on it. They're definitely working on it. Okay, your second one is in retail, Chow Tai Fook. No one's going to know this company here in the U.S. So tell us about it and why this makes the outlook.
That and the next one on the list from an alphabetical perspective are both sort of interesting twists on the same underlying theme, and that's China. We all know that there's problems in China from the standpoint of the property market and how that's playing through in terms of sentiment, the wealth effect on spending plans, etc. Chow Tai Fook is arguably the best known Chinese retailer when it comes to jewelry. And it's a big market historically for tourists and travelers coming into Hong Kong and to make those purchases. In fact, what we're seeing right now is Hong Kongers are going out of Hong Kong across the border into mainland China to shop for pretty much everything because it's cheaper. So you combine that with negative sentiment. We think Hong Kong retail sales are going to disappoint, and Chow Tai Fook is a poster child. The other one, CSC Financial, is one of the largest Chinese brokerages, you know, good old fashioned, you know, wealth management. And there, the investment banking business, we think, is set for disappointment because IPOs and other new stock listings are way underwater. You know, we think you're going to see investment banking revenue disappoint.
You know, I was looking through the list here, Tim, and I was looking for a name from Michael Dean and the European Autos team. And I think I found one in Pirelli Tires.
Yes, indeed. I started to say if you're an F1 fan, but that's more from a European perspective than NASCAR in the U.S.
Right.
But Pirelli is a well-known tire maker, and what they're doing is twofold. Number one, upgrading their mix. They're getting rid of some of their lower-end products. And number two, they've taken on a pretty big initiative to shift production from core Europe to places like Romania over here and Mexico over there, all of which is driving better margins. And we think that this is going to continue more than what consensus currently bakes in.
Plus, it's from one of my favorite analysts over in our London office, Jillian Davis, doing some good work there.
Work.
So good stuff.
Home building. Taylor Morrison made the list. That's not normally the company you think of when you think of like a home builder, right? You're thinking Lennar, KB Homes, etc. How did this one make the list?
They're continuing to expand specifically in some larger developments in Florida and Texas. And it just seems to be a case of good old-fashioned running the numbers with those expansion plans feeding through and their order book coming through better than anticipated, where we think there are positive surprises ahead. But it is a classic story from the standpoint of expanding order books, expanding volumes.
You know, one name that's on there that's surprising, but I think it's a potential real opportunity here is Tencent. Talk to that big Chinese e-commerce, because for a lot of people, Tim, as you well know, China is kind of taboo right now from an investment perspective.
It is, especially when it comes to technology and regulatory concerns and, you know, Beijing focusing in on, you know, what the big tech companies are doing. You know, historically, these have Tencent's driven by online gaming, and that growth rate is still somewhat muted, but there's more video that's coming through. There's AI-assisted advertising that is growing. Both of those are drivers of their income statement that we think are underappreciated. We think it's mid-teens growth going forward, but if you do the math, the market seems to be discounting basically static to maybe low single-digit growth rates. And so there, it's just a case where we think the market doesn't realize that they're back to having good, solid forward growth.
Our thanks to Tim Craighead, Bloomberg Intelligence Research Director, for content.
All right, coming up, we're going to discuss what Tesla's first quarter delivery miss means for the EV space.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We look next at the EV space. So this week, Tesla reported first quarter vehicle deliveries that fell 14% short of analyst expectations. And this also represented Tesla's first year-over-year decline in deliveries since 2020.
This comes as the EV maker Rivian reported that it delivered more EVs last quarter than Wall Street expected. For more on all of this, we were joined by Steve Mann, Global Autos and Industrials Research Analyst. We first asked Steve what Tesla's miss means for the company going forward.
I mean, it's a bad time. You know, they just actually raise prices on their cars, puts in the question about that strategy. There's a lot of questions out there, you know, with, you know, the end market, the consumer hesitating a bit on buying EVs. So what's going to be for Tesla going forward? Definitely their 1.8 million target, sales target for the year is definitely at risk.
Do we know why? Like, what's the why behind it? Like, they're going to talk about production misses in terms of supply chain issues, etc. But then Rivian kind of crushed it. So what's the real reason here?
Yeah, they actually, you know, Tesla attributed it to the Red Sea hostilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's partly right, because a lot of their Model 3 and Model Y, the best-selling vehicles actually come from China. And, you know, you would assume a lot of these vehicles are shipped through the Pacific Ocean, avoiding the Red Sea. But we'll give them benefit of the doubt that it had some impact. Maybe it's not necessarily the shipment of vehicles, maybe the shipment of parts, right, through the Red Sea that's impacted the production in China. And remember, they actually cut some production in China recently as well. So, you know, that could be the reason. But like you said, Rivian sales have gone up. You know, is there anything specific to Tesla? I don't really think so. One quarter is not gonna tell us the trend for the long term. I think Tesla vehicles are still, you know, liked by a lot of consumers. We just did a survey actually, recently, a buying intention survey. You know, Tesla has the greatest brand loyalty still amongst all brands in the auto industry. Yes.
The big question on investors' minds is, what is the real demand for EVs in general, and Tesla in particular, look in, the, I guess, the near and intermediate term? Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that not only Tesla, but the entire EV market is going through a rough patch this year and likely into the next year. You know, my long-term view is still optimistic about EVs. I think there's enough policies out there to push, you know, greener vehicles, more greener vehicles on the road. I think the issue today is about affordability. There's actually not enough affordable EVs out there for the masses. Currently, a lot of vehicles are expensive. They're over $50,000. Not a lot of people can buy them, especially during high interest rate environments.
That has been the rhetoric, really, for a bit. And Elon Musk seems to say, okay, we're going to do the lower cost, but give us a second, right? We had this wave of Model Y, Model 3, et cetera, and now we're going to have another wave of more affordable EVs. When does that wave happen?
A lot of it actually comes online at the end of 2025, starts coming online at the end of 2025. That's when you have the Model 2. GM is also relaunching the more affordable Bolt. All of them are, you know, $30,000 or less. And then you have, you know, GM will continue to roll out cheaper vehicles. And you have Rivian also launching the R2 and R3, you know, in 2026 and 2027.
So who doesn't want a car named R2, by the way?
Yeah.
Total side note. I mean, everyone. But go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of more affordable EVs coming in. And the hope is that, you know, the addressable market for the EV market, for the EV industry expands as cheaper cars come on the road and are available to consumers.
If I were an investor in this company, I'd be saying, okay, you need to bring in a cheaper priced car for the mass market, but I'm not sure you can convince me that you can do it at a profit. What's the expectation of their ability to churn out lower priced models on a per unit profitable basis?
That's a very good question. I think scale is the most important thing. I mean, this is a scale volume game in the auto industry, has been like that for 100 years. So the question is, are the cheaper vehicles gonna resonate? As you push more production through an assembly plant in the auto industry, the unit cost does fall significantly in a logarithmic kind of trend. So we're hoping that it will cut. But specifically to Tesla, I want to also mention that they've done a really good job in vertically integrating their processes throughout the whole value chain, right? And that actually does cut costs, especially in, you know, newer tech like this. You know, if I look at over 100 years ago, Henry Ford basically did the same thing, you know, switching everybody from horse carriages to automobiles actually required Ford to vertically integrate and able to manage costs and manage design and be nimble and flexible to react to consumer tastes.
Our thanks to Steve Mann, Global Autos and Industrial Research Analyst.
Earlier in the week, we were joined by Matt Winkler, Editor-in-Chief Emeritus at Bloomberg News. He's also been writing a series of opinion pieces on key swing states in the U.S.
In Matt's latest piece, his research focused on Georgia, whose economy has been booming over the last few decades. We began our conversation with Matt by asking him to discuss his findings in Georgia.
Georgia, population of more than 11 million, makes
really?
It the eighth largest state. And it's booming right now like it never did before Joe Biden became the 46th president. And we know this because not since data was initially collected in 1990 has there been a three-year period when growth in the Peach State's manufacturing payrolls came close to matching the 11.9% increase in jobs since 2021. Or its rate of employment gains compared with the U.S. overall. And that's according to data compiled by Bloomberg. So we are seeing a manufacturing boom, job boom in Georgia, the likes of which Georgia has never seen. And by the way, this is counter to the trend in the 21st century. Every presidency in the new century, except Biden's, has seen a decline in manufacturing jobs. So this is a departure.
So how much of that do you attribute to the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act? Because something that gets lost in all this messaging is with the IRA, for example, so much of that money is actually going to red states because they have the space to, like, build stuff.
Well, there's no question that actually red states are a big beneficiary. But it's not just the American Rescue Act of 2021. It's also the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, again, the Inflation Reduction Act, all of which have helped Biden make a legitimate claim, which is he created close to 800,000 manufacturing jobs since he took office. And we know this is not an idle boast because those very careful fact checkers called PolitiFact actually took a look at this claim and they showed that the nation's manufacturing rebound is the strongest at this point after a recession since 1951.
Is Georgia per se doing anything right versus, I mean, is this all just the largesse of the federal government, Matt, or does Georgia have just better incentives, better tax incentives? Are they doing something maybe some other states aren't doing well?
Well, there's no question that some of the credit has to go to, as I said, these acts, because the investments include, for example, South Korea's Hanwha Solutions Corp. expansion of solar panel and manufacturing. They were already there. They got incentives to do a lot more than what they were doing. The same thing with Hyundai, with EV vehicles. They're already there. They're doing more. And then there's this battery company from Norway, Freyr Battery, which is going to make clean battery manufacturing in Coweta County in Georgia. So those things are definitely tied to the incentives that come out of these acts. There's no question state and local officials have been supportive, but interestingly enough, the governor of Georgia voted against or would have voted against the Inflation Reduction Act. All of the Republicans in Congress voted against the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a big part of why Georgia's doing well. But they're not ready to give the money back.
Of course not. No.
They're very happy that it's all happening.
We have seen with some of these acts that we get all excited about the money that's being spent, but then getting the shovel in the ground and actually doing the hiring and the manufacturing gets delayed a little bit and gets pushed out, or the plans get scaled back a bit. Are we seeing any of this in Georgia, or is the outlook particularly rosy?
It's more of the latter, you know, and again, the proof of that is that if you look at the unemployment rate in Georgia. It actually declined most recently and is several percentage points, you know, less than the national average. So, you know, unemployment in the U.S. actually has ticked up a bit. In Georgia, it's gone the other way. And that's an example that the boom is very much underway and shows no signs of abating.
You know, you have to remind yourself, I mean, how the economy in the South has really changed from, you know, agricultural, textiles, you know, very low technology touch types of industries, to now it seems like every new auto plant that, you know, international automakers, they want to build them in
movie studios too.
So much investment's going to the Southeast, and that's again been a 30-year story. What's next on your
the
list?
The next state.
Yeah, what state is next year?
We'll probably get to Nevada. I think so. We've done Pennsylvania, Michigan.
Yep.
Now Georgia, and we're working through the list.
So if you were advising President Biden his campaign about the messaging here, what would you say in terms of, because I would argue that the messaging has not been effective, that this message of economic success has not been told well.
I'd say actually their messaging has been pretty good. A lot of this data that we've compiled at Bloomberg is available in various announcements from either the White House or the Treasury. But the saying is, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't get the horse to drink. The horse in this case is our profession, the media, and it's pretty much ignored what's in front of its nose, which are the facts. So unless reporters find this relevant, I do.
Yep. Which is why we love having you on for it.
You know, they'd rather focus on polls, and so that's perception, not reality.
Before we went on the air, you made a comment about California. How big is that economy now? Because to me, it was the seventh or eighth largest economy.
It's number four.
It's now number four.
Wow. And it's poised to overtake Germany. And that's because, if you know, you keep talking about the Magnificent Seven on this show. And,
yep.
If you look at corporate California just dwarfs corporate anywhere. It dwarfs corporate Texas. It dwarfs corporate Germany. Corporate California is still a juggernaut. And you know who those companies are. But it's not just the big companies. It's big and small companies alike in the Russell 3000 that make California unique.
Our thanks to Matt Winkler, Editor-in-Chief Emeritus at Bloomberg News.
Coming up on the program, we're going to take a look at the expanded partnership between UPS and the United States Postal Service.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We turn now to the logistics industry. UPS announced this week that it had been awarded a significant air cargo contract by the United States Postal Service. This comes after FedEx said its agreement to provide domestic transportation services for USPS will expire on September 29th.
For more, we were joined by Lee Klaskow, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Transport, Logistics, and Shipping Analyst. We first asked Lee for his reaction to UPS becoming the primary air cargo provider for USPS.
This is somewhat of a surprise. I think most people were expecting that FedEx would lose maybe about half of that business, but they ended up losing all of it. It's about $1.7 to $1.9 billion in revenue. Makes up roughly around 4 to 5% of their express business, maybe 2% of their total business. So it's a big loss for FedEx. And, you know, while FedEx is losing, UPS is gaining. What's great about this is maybe not so much the revenue and the yields that it provides. It's the stability of the freight that it's going to be getting into its network. And when you have any sort of a freight network, you want equilibrium. You want to be able to predict what you're going to need in terms of resources, and this provides a good level set of predictability for them, and they can build density onto these routes where the U.S. Postal Service will be leveraging.
Why is the Postal Service making the switch?
That's a great question. They were negotiating with FedEx. I guess the two parties couldn't come to a conclusion in terms of an agreement. So therefore, they just decided to part ways. You know, one would guess that this is maybe not the most high margin business for whether it's UPS or FedEx. But again, I think there is a benefit to having this because it does create a lot of density in their network.
Let me ask a silly question. When I'm looking to mail a package, the United States Postal Service does not even come into my mindset.
Oh, God, no.
No. Uses the U.S. Postal Service versus FedEx or you know, a UPS store that's right next to the Starbucks in town? I can go, you know, get my cafe mocha there
all
and do
the
all
things,
that kind of stuff.
Yep.
I'm not going to the post office. Who uses the post office these days?
I mean, I do. I guess I'm a boomer.
You do?
But
you know better.
I do sometimes. But the reality is the Postal Service, you know, obviously, you know, we're not sending letters to grandma anymore. But, you know, what we are doing is we're ordering stuff online. And the U.S. Postal Service provides a lot of the final mile delivery. So you might be ordering from a department store or, you know, a .com e-tailer. And, you know, they might be using UPS and FedEx for the line haul, but they might be leveraging the Postal Service for that final mile delivery because the Postal Service, at the end of the day, has to go to everyone's address, and it's a cheap way to do it. And as more and more people are willing, maybe you don't need that T-shirt overnight, you can wait a couple days, you know, injecting that freight into the Postal Service makes sense. And Amazon is a big user of that final mile delivery as well.
Hmm. My daughter does send letters to her grandmother.
Nice.
I'm just putting that out there. On the flip side, and I should point out, they mentioned the margin part of it. So we talked to the UPS CEO last week on television, and their whole pitch is that going forward, they want to focus on margin and pricing over volume. Does this fit into that strategy?
Yes and no. So what they're going to be focusing on are verticals like small to mid-size shippers. And those shippers come with very high margins relative to, you know, large enterprise companies that are out there. So they're going to be really focused on that type of business. But, you know, what the volumes from the Postal Service brings is a level of density that you can leverage because it's all about operational leverage, right? You know, no matter what you are in transportation, operational leverage is pretty high because you add like one more piece of freight, that piece of freight tends to have higher margins than the first 20 pieces of freight. And so what this will do is this will probably help them provide a base level of cost coverage and, you know, a profitable cost coverage at that. And then all these additional volumes that they're getting from higher margin might even carry higher incremental margins for UPS. So long term, it could have a very positive impact on margins. Near term, it might have a negative mix shift, if you will. But, you know, we think that it does make sense for them to take this volume. And other verticals also that they talked about during their analyst day were the healthcare vertical, which tends to be highly profitable just because of the high touch nature and the high service level of that freight that goes through their network.
So, Lee, looking at the air freight companies, the FedEx, the UPS, how is business? How are volumes these days? Are they kind of peeled off from the pandemic, or how is volume?
Yeah, so, you know, we're coming off those highs that we reached during the pandemic when everyone was sitting at home and ordering toilet paper online, or at least trying to get some toilet paper online. You know, we're back to a more normalized level. You know, the reality is that what the pandemic has done is it really increased that e-commerce penetration, kind of brought the penetration forward by 3 to 5 years, which is a net positive. But, you know, we have to go back to this quote-unquote normalization process, which feels like a negative, but it's really not, because once we get this base, which I think we're building right now, you know, we should see positive growth from here on out.
Our thanks to Lee Klaskow, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Transport Logistics and Shipping Analyst.
This week, we took a look at the big take story. Hubris at Hertz doomed its massive bet on 100,000 Teslas. It's about how two finance veterans bought Hertz out of bankruptcy to save it.
The big take piece takes an inside look at how their big idea to go all in on EVs and Tesla went wrong in almost every way. We were joined by Eric Schatzker, Bloomberg New Economy editorial director, who co-wrote the big take piece, and we first asked Eric for some context.
The experience of a Tesla owner
is very different from the experience of a Tesla renter. And going into this big bet on 100,000 Teslas, they placed an order for 100,000 Teslas, in fact, back in 2021. The new owners at Hertz didn't appreciate that. There were no data, to be fair, on what it was like for a rental car company to have EVs in the fleet because none did. Hertz was going to be the first. And so they did look at the data. How do Teslas perform when they're owned by individuals? And generally speaking, Teslas perform well. They don't require a lot of maintenance. Obviously, refueling the car, so to speak, is a matter of plugging it in. But if it's your Tesla, it probably sits in your garage or it sits in your driveway. Or maybe if you live in a city like New York, it's at a parking garage and you've had a charger put in. That's all fine, and these people tend not to get into a lot of accidents, and they don't have range anxiety because they own the car. They made the decision to buy it. It's a totally different story. When you get off of a red-eye flight and, you know, stroll up to the Hertz counter and are told that, no, I'm sorry, the car you reserved is not available, but we're giving you a Tesla, if you've never been behind the wheel of an EV, it can be a terrifying experience. You don't know. You don't want to have to find a charger in the wild. You don't know what this instantaneous braking is like.
You don't know how to turn on the car.
You don't realize that it has rocket-like acceleration. And as a result, Hertz, with its Tesla fleet, started running into all kinds of problems. They were crashing, and it's very expensive to repair a Tesla. In many cases, they have to be junked because insurance companies are worried about the damage that might have occurred to the battery. People didn't want to rent them, so the demand wasn't there. And then, of course, Elon Musk cut Tesla prices by 30% and kind of blew a hole into Hertz's balance sheet.
The economic model. How did Hertz get into this position?
It's a good question. This was a rental car company, the only major rental car company that went bankrupt in the early days of the pandemic.
I'm a Gold Circle member of Hertz, by the way. I just stroll right up to my car, John.
Some people have very good experiences with Hertz, including Paul Sweeney, evidently.
Yeah, you got a Tesla.
So Hertz went bankrupt. It was bought out of bankruptcy in June 2021 by two professional investors. Tom Wagner runs Knighthead Capital, and Greg O'Hara is the founding partner at Certares Management. They raised $1.5 billion fund. They wanted to find travel and leisure companies that had been crushed by the pandemic, but of course, which in theory would soar once the economy reopened, and Hertz seemed like a great candidate. And actually, that part of the thesis played out perfectly. Once the economy reopened, in fact, before the economy reopened, when people realized getting into a car and driving somewhere doesn't put me at risk of COVID at all, demand for rentals went sky high. And so coming out of this acquisition from bankruptcy, Hertz was crushing it, but they had a transformational plan to turn it into a largely electrified rental car company. And that's where everything went pear-shaped. I talked about it, the demand, the damage, the price cuts. And we say it's a tale of hubris because in many respects it is. Of course, everything looks clear in hindsight. It did sound like an incredibly good idea at the time. And I think for the sake of the planet, it would be nice if you could electrify a rental car company and save, you know, the environment from all the gasoline that gets poured into rental cars. But it just doesn't work in practice. And whether it's arrogance, whether it's hubris, whether it's blind optimism, it could be a combination of all those three. These new owners, these professional investors, one who runs a hedge fund, the other who runs a private equity firm, thought that they had an answer for this industry that the industry itself had ignored for years. And the truth of the matter is, running any company in any industry is tough, right? It requires some experience, maybe.
And the funny thing is, well, not for them, but is that they could be right, just either a little early or a little late, depending on how you look at it. Like making,
you know, whenever we talk about early, right,
it's
the broken clock thing, right? Broken clock is right two times a day. In the case of being early,
I thought it was a great strategy when I first heard
it.
Of course. It sounded, it hit so many buttons there. But I guess it kind of goes to the bigger question, which we asked the auto industry. Have we seen peak interest in EVs?
But this is why I found the article so interesting, because there were things that I didn't think about in that they don't have dealerships, right?
No.
So they don't have a relationship with dealerships. So like when my Subaru tire gets, you know, messed up, we just drive it in and then they fix it and then we drive out kind of thing. You can't do that with a Tesla. I never thought of that, for example. I never thought of how difficult it would be to all of a sudden get off a plane and go sit in a Tesla. It's weird enough getting in the morning to a Tesla and getting in the back seat. I can't imagine just being shoved into the front seat and having to drive it at the same time. And these little details I found to be very provocative.
Well, they are, as you say, something of an indication as to why demand for EVs right now is slowing. Hertz, you know, we can play on the fact that it even has yellow as part of its logo, was the canary in the coal mine for the EV industry. What began to happen at Hertz is what the rest of the industry is beginning to wake up to, that all of the EVs that are being cranked out right now may not have a natural buyer because people aren't enough chargers out there. People haven't gotten over this idea that it's a different driving experience. People, as we all know, are very personal about their cars, right? It's an extension of themselves, and you don't want your arm to feel like it doesn't belong on your body. And that's, in some respects, how people feel about getting behind the wheel of an EV.
Our thanks to Eric Schatzker, Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.